So tonight is the second of the series of three talks I'm giving on the seven factors of awakening. And here we're talking about the what are called the arousing factors, Dhamma Vachaya, which gets usually translated as investigation, but I'll talk about that in a minute. And then Virya, which is translated both as effort and energy. And piti, which is often translated as rapture, which is another translation I'm not crazy about, and I'll talk about that. So how you translate these things sometimes affects how people see them. Anyhow, I want to start actually by reading something. We're going to have a lot of things from Joseph Goldstein tonight. So, this is Joseph talking about what happens when your mindfulness, remember the first factor of was mindfulness. What happens when you've got that, when your mindfulness is clear and crisp? This salient understanding highlights the importance of using the power of mindfulness in the service of wisdom. As Sayadaw Up Tenjaniya has emphasized, awareness alone is not enough. So just being mindful in and of itself is wonderful, but it's the beginning of the seven factors of awakening. For mindfulness to function as a factor of awakening, it has to be the springboard for investigation. When mindfulness brings us face to face with the object, what do we learn? It is this investigative aspect of non-delusion that is the direct link to the next of the factors of awakening, the wisdom factors of mind called discrimination of states, which is another way that investigation is translated. So, this is Dhamma Vachaya. So, the reason I don't like the word investigation, which is often how this is translated, is investigation in our culture mind always sort of implies figuring things out. Right? I'm investigating the problem to try and solve it, right? And that's not really what we're talking about here at all. This isn't that sort of process. It's not a logical step-by-step thinking about something. It's something quite different. And basically, once mindfulness is really crisp and functioning, and as Joseph said, we apply it, we start to see very clearly that all the things we're being mindful of, no matter what they are, no matter what they are, all the things we're being mindful of have underneath them the same three qualities. They're all impermanent, they're all unsatisfactory, and they're all not self. And we This now becomes something that we see and that we experience as opposed to something we think about. So we're not trying to figure things out. It's just, we start to see something arises, it's there for a while, and oh, it's gone. Oh, and there's another one. Oh, it's there, and it's gone. And that's the nature of it all. So we're sort of stepping back from the content. Seeing that the content, no matter what it is, wonderful, horrible, crazy, wild, boring, no matter what kind of content we've got, it's all the same. And we lose some of our interest in the content of what's arising at the level of mind and start to see the underlying patterns instead. This is what Dhamma Vachaya is about. Joseph, I like how Joseph calls this the discrimination of states. Right? We're starting to see that everything has exactly this stream of stuff No matter what it is, all has exactly the same underlying flavor. It's always just stuff arising, it's there, it's gone. It's all unsatisfactory, by which we mean, what's arising in and of itself never has the ability to make us permanently happy. Because it's always changing. Because it's impermanent, it's unsatisfactory. And because it's impermanent and constantly arising and changing, we start to see that there's no one home. There's no self there who's experiencing all this. What we think of itself is just what's arising in the moment and passing. And so what's happening here is we're starting to see the Buddhist teachings in a non-intellectual way, as in an experiential way instead. Like, we can all sort of intellectually go, yeah, that makes sense. Everything's impermanent and non-satisfactory, and and even that not-self stuff sort of makes sense in a way. But as an intellectual understanding, it's not doesn't go far enough. It's just intellectual, which is useful, because without the intellectual understanding, we wouldn't understand what was going on when we start to actually see these things. It would just be like, what the heck's that? So we need the intellectual basis as a ground from which this understanding, this investigation can arise. Right. I want to share a couple of other things with Joseph here. This is, he's talking about the momentum of mindfulness. There's an early insight into the nature of mind-body process that comes both from this continuity of mindfulness, remember I talked about continuity last week, and also strengthens it. The understanding through our own experience that in every moment of knowing and its object are arising simultaneously. Knowing and the object that we're knowing are arising simultaneously. We can't separate those. It's like they're happening at the same moment. Knowing the object and the object arising are simultaneous. There's the in-breath and the simultaneous knowing of it, the out-breath and the knowing of it. A visual object arises, and in that very moment, there is a knowing of it. This is true of every aspect of our experience. And this insight is the first doorway into understanding of selflessness, and it is a stage of insight called purification of view. We begin to see that everything that we call self is simply this pairwise progression of knowing and object, arising and passing moment after moment. And we also see that knowing in each moment arises due to impersonal causes and not because there is some abiding knower. So we say that knowing, consciousness, arises spontaneously when the appropriate causes and conditions are present. Going even deeper, we see that the knowing faculty is not altered or affected by what is known. So what we're seeing, what we're realizing, doesn't affect the process itself at all. It's just what's there. And this realization has liberating consequences for both our meditation practice and our lives. In meditation, as we go from painful sensations to pleasant ones, we see that the basic quality of knowing is not altered. It is simply aware of what is arising. One example of the profound consequences of this understanding is the description of Henry David Thoreau's last days. He died of tuberculosis at the early age of 44. In a biography of his life, his friends described his frame of mind. I love this. Henry was never affected, never reached by his illness. Very often I heard him tell his visitors that he enjoyed existence as well as ever. He remarked to me that there was as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health, the mind almost conforming to the condition of the body. The thought of death, he said, could not begin to trouble him. During his long illness, I never heard a murmur escape him, or the slightest wish expressed to remain with us. His perfect contentment was truly wonderful. Some of his more orthodox friends and relatives tried to prepare him for death, but with little satisfaction themselves. When his Aunt Louisa asked him if he had made his peace with God, he answered, "I did not know that we'd ever quarreled, Aunt." It's like, it's all okay. He had a pretty deep understanding. I think a secret Buddhist understanding or something. And then there's one other thing I want to share about this. And this is another level of this investigation and seeing things more clearly that I think is quite important. Joseph calls this recognizing habit patterns of suffering. Truth discerning wisdom also comes into play when we find ourselves caught in major storms of afflictive emotions or simply acting out our basic personality tendencies. In these situations, Ajahn Chah's reminder that there are two kinds of suffering, one that leads to more suffering and one that leads to its end, can prompt the arising of discernment of Dhamma. Instead of getting lost in and acting out habitual patterns of suffering, in times of emotional turbulence, we can first investigate what is going on, that is, the nature of the emotion itself. Then we see how we are relating to that emotion. Are we claiming it as I or mine? Sometimes the simple act of clear recognition is enough to come to a place of acceptance and letting go. Instead of being tossed about, you ever feel like you're tossed about by your mind? In storms of undifferentiated emotions, we can begin to discern whether our emotion is fear or loneliness, boredom or unhappiness. Clarity of discernment through investigation of dhammas can bring acceptance because we are aligning ourselves accurately with the present moment experience. It is a way of acknowledging, yes, this is what is here. From this place of acceptance, we can then see more clearly the impermanent, selfless nature of the emotion and free ourselves from identifying with it, letting go and letting be. I'm sure you all know people who have a story they tell themselves about why they're unhappy and why they're suffering and what's wrong and blah, 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 blah. And because they believe that story so long, because it's their identity, it's who they are, it's the I, how they describe themselves, they're trapped in that process, in a sense. And what he's saying here is, no. If you can step back and just see this identification of this is who I am, I'm the person who this happened to, and oh, poor me, and blah, 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 all the suffering stuff that arises, the thoughts that arise out of that, then it's a way to step outside that and not be caught by that process. But it's like we have to investigate and see that that's just the nature of what's arising now. It's a liberating idea, I think, more than anything else. And furthermore, this is another idea. This investigation or discrimination leads us to have an ability to distinguish between what is wholesome and what is unwholesome or unskillful. We actually start to see, oh, this pattern I'm caught in, which is just a pattern. It's also an unwholesome pattern. It leads me to, getting deeper into suffering and causing suffering of others around me, for that matter. And some of the commentaries, this ability to discriminate in this way is the antidote to doubt. Because doubt is always like, oh, is this good for me? I don't know if I should be doing this. I don't know if this teacher's any good. Who knows what this Buddhist stuff, I should be studying Tai Bo or something, whatever. I don't know what the latest thing is. That's what doubt says. And if you start to see, no, it's clear to me that this practice, this teacher, this teaching, whatever, that I'm doing something wholesome. And that's leading to more wholesomeness. This eradicates doubt. Remember last week I mentioned that the seven factors of awakening are considered antidotes to the five kilesas, doubt being actually the hardest one to deal with in some cases. And it's just because you start to see so clearly how by following the Buddhist teachings, you're tending, sometimes slowly, slowly, but you're always tending towards more wholesomeness in your life. And that encourages you in a sense to, oh, this actually makes sense. So sometimes, and so this is a practice hint, how can I turn on in this particular factor of awakening? How can I actualize Dhamma Vachaya in my practice? There you are, you're being quite still and focused and mindful. But it just seems like there's just stuff there. I can remember sitting there and just sort of watching this stuff go by, like, oh, there's that one, there's that one. And none of it was grabbing me. But it was like just, I sort of felt like I was stuck there, just in this sort of seeing things. And what Joseph recommends in another place, and I found is really helpful, is that right at that point you drop a little question into your mind, like something like, what's going on? What's happening right now? Like you actually ask yourself that question, not expecting a specific answer at all, but just as a way to sort of jolt you out of your pattern of just being, and heading towards the more deeper wisdom that's available if you just look not at the surface, but underneath the surface. But that's that asking that question often is what'll take you down. So this is another way as we go deeper into the practice, we see that, yes, we're just paying attention to what's arising in the moment, but sometimes we have to give it a little nudge, in a sense. Sometimes this is a skillful thing to do. Just ask the question, not expecting some long discursive thing, not trying to understand. You're not trying to, get an explanation. You're just trying to sort of go, I need to nudge myself a little bit here. That's the way I think of it more than anything else. Yeah. And maybe whatever you find a phrase of, what the heck's going on? I mean, it might be whatever, whatever works for you, So that's Dhamma Vachaya. I think it's a really interesting thing, the whole idea of Dhamma Vachaya itself. And also, I think it's important that we understand that mindfulness, just being mindful, just having that clear, mindful presence, is the beginning of the seven factors of awakening. And it leads to this sort of deeper looking. And then this mindfulness act is active, Dhamma Vachaya is active, then that leads to the next factor. And this is the same, so this is a progressive teaching. And all this, steps one and two got to be there before step three gets turned on, for instance. And sometimes this happens sort of intuitively. You're not like planning it out or making a big project out of it, but you just start to see this is what's happening. So the next of these factors is virya, which I translated as energy sometimes translated as effort. I spoke a fair amount about this a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the Eightfold Path. But I want to sort of look at this from another couple of angles just to sort of fit it into this story. Also, by the way, this is considered the antidote to sloth and torpor, which makes sense, right? Putting energy, putting effort is going to the antidote to sloth and torpor. But this is like, this is wholesome and wholesome effort, wise effort, but it has a sort of a different sort of flavor to it in a sense. And here Joseph is talking about balancing what he calls balancing the quality of effort. Understanding different nuances of virya, energy, strength, courage. Right, talked about those are the sometimes virya gets translated as courage because what we're doing is quite courageous. Like we're saying, we're going against the flow of what our culture tells us to do. You know, to actually look at your mind and how it works is not something we're encouraged to do very often. Certainly not in this way. Understanding different nuances of virya, energy, strength, courage, brings us to the thorny problem of understanding the relationship between all these qualities and effort. What is effort? When is it balanced? When is it counterproductive? Effort is an expenditure of energy to accomplish some objective. It's like the dictionary definition, right? Effort is an expenditure of energy to accomplish some objective. But the word effort in English has so many connotations that we need to carefully examine its skillful application and practice. To do that, we will first look at its unskillful application. Effort can become unskillful when there is a forcing of the mind, what I call efforting, rather than a relaxation of mind. Effort becomes unskillful when there is some idea of gain and the mind full of expectations, rather than an openness and receptivity to what is already there. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about this as being of mindfulness as being aimlessness, which I think is a great. It's like we, as soon as we have some idea of what's going to happen, what I'm going to get, then the effort can become unskillful because now we're trying to create something as opposed to just being aware of what's there. This is a tricky balance because at the same time we have to like put in the effort to really practice and be firm and steady in our practice, but we have to have that firm steadiness without expectation or ideas of the results, which is kind of tricky. Smart. Western mind, like we always think, if I put in effort, I should get something, right? And what we're saying is, no. You have to put in effort, put energy into the practice, understanding that you have no idea what's going to arise. You're just doing the practice. You're putting in the effort. And then Joseph goes on to describe a whole long time when he got caught in this in his practice. Early on, and he was having this amazing experience, and he was trying to have this experience again. All been caught there. This is so he goes on. Finally, after all that time, I let go of wanting and settled back with acceptance into what was presenting itself. And although the body of light didn't return in the same way, there was an easeful flow of phenomena arising and passing in each moment. I realized that I'd been dragging around the corpse of previous experience, trying to reclaim something that had changed and passed. I love that description of the corpse of past experience. It's like this is a place where it's so easy to get caught in this practice. Something we have this idea that oh it was like that was a good sit, therefore now I have to make my good sit occur again. And we get caught in that place of trying to make that same thing happen, as opposed to just understanding that every sit's a good sit. The fact that you sat, that's good. End of discussion. Whatever arose, whatever's arising, it's all good. The lesson here is that we need to be mindful of how we're making effort. If there is a strong agenda, the in order to mind I've spoken of, being aware in order for something in particular to happen, or for holding on to the object too tightly, afraid we'll lose it. I'm going to stay with the breath, and if it kills me, right? I'm going to really keep concentrating, and that doesn't work either. Then we need to open and relax the mind, softening the quality of our effort. On the other hand, if the mind is continually drifting off and there's no effort to investigate what's going on, there's investigation, right? Then we need to strengthen this effort factor. So what he's saying is, if mindfulness there and investigation is there and we're applying effort, and then we see, oh wait, investigation isn't there anymore. The ground for wholesome effort has slipped away. Now go back and pay more attention, put in more effort into this, tuning into that underlying flow of things, and then come back and put more effort into other things. And so once again, this is where, as we become more skillful in our practice, we start to go, oh, I can see I'm sort of just spacing out here. Time to bear down, put more effort in, try and be a bit crisper in my attention. But at the same time, it's like we don't want to sort of force ourselves to be, I'm going to be crisp whether it kills me. We don't want to go there either because that just gets in the way. So it's like this interesting balancing act we're always working with. And sometimes we'll see that we're overdoing it when either mindfulness itself or the energy of investigation isn't there anymore. So I've lost the foundation from which the energy should be applied. Balancing. But at the same time, it's always one more thing, right? This is Joseph talking about, in a sense, what motivates us to put in that effort. What is it that we go, oh yeah, I really need to do this? It's called spiritual urgency. Proximate cause for the arising of virya as a factor of enlightenment is the feeling of spiritual urgency. So in other words, without that sense of spiritual urgency, this idea of effort as a awakening factor won't be there. We have to have this sense of, and then he goes on to describe this, right? The Buddha talked of attending to these awakening factors as a matter of vital concern and not something simply as we do in our off hours. This is the core of this deeper practice. There are some powerful reflections that remind us of this urgency. We can reflect on the preciousness of our present circumstances. Whether we think of it in the context of many lives or just in this life, we can see and appreciate how rare it is for all the conditions to come together in order for us to hear the Dhamma, even more so for us to have the interest, motivation, and opportunity to practice. We often think that conditions will always be favorable, but any look at the world around us reveals the truth of uncertainty. From war and violence to natural disasters to our own aging bodies. Wise reflection on the uncertainties of conditions heightens the appreciation of our present circumstances and thus becomes the cause for the arisal of energy. This is sort of what he's pointing to is some sense of reflection. we forget so easily how lucky we are, how we have these bodies that are healthy, that we have a life that's easy enough that we actually can say, well, I think I'll just put some time into this idea called meditation, because I'm not just constantly trying to, you know, get enough food or keep myself from being blown up or whatever goes on in the world, which is a lot of what goes on in the world for other people. And then we reflect, not only that, I've sort of, somehow or other, I got connected to this thing called the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha, and have become really interested in them. And spiritual urgency tells me, oh, these conditions may not last another day. We don't know. I heard from my son literally just before I started this sit. He just got laid off after 4.5 years. 9% of his company just got dumped. It's like, just like that, his whole life is getting changed. He doesn't know what the next job's gonna be. He's really highly skilled. I'm not worried about him or anything. But it was like, just like that, the world changes. You never know how it's gonna be or what's gonna happen. It's like not straightforward in any sense at all. So this idea that things can change at any moment, sort of, if we have that in the back of our mind, it's like, oh, this could be, I mean, this is a dramatic way of thinking of it, this could be the last time I ever get to practice. Can every time I sit down to practice, can I have that thought? And not like, oh, well, I'll be able to practice tomorrow for sure. I mean, why not? You know, life goes on. But it doesn't. And so we both reflect both on how fortunate we are to have found this practice and found the teachings and be able to practice it. But the understanding that, just like everything else, these fortunate conditions are totally impermanent. Can change at any moment. It sort of wakes us up in a sense and makes us want to put energy into the practice. But so now we have mindfulness. We have this investigative energy, putting energy in a balanced way, we're inspired to do so, and we're aware of that inspiration. And then the next factor of awakening is pitti, which is often translated as rapture. And as I think as I mentioned, I'm not particularly crazy about that translation, because to me, growing up as I did in a Christian world, rapture was always like, you know, speaking in tongues and dancing with snakes sort of vibe, you know. the word gives me the heebie-jeebies, and I just go, no, you know? And so I think I like, and I don't have a particular single word for it. Sometimes you see pitti translated as joy, but I don't think that's particularly accurate either, because it's more than joy. It's like, you know, there you are, mindful, putting in, you know, seeing the underlying pieces of what's going on at the level of mind, putting in energy, and then joy arises. It's like the sense of like, wow, is this ever interesting? This is so cool. That's what arises. It's like. But you know, what's the word for that? You know, I have to be careful I don't turn into a hippie again. You know what I mean? But that's where it's coming from. It's that sort of thing. It's like, this is just so amazing, and you just start to see things so clearly, and it just makes you happy. It brings joy, just purely, and has nothing to do with getting anything or anything other than what's arising and what you're seeing and how you're seeing it so clearly and precisely. In and of itself, brings joy into your experience. So that's one aspect of pitti. And it arises very clearly under the first three factors, being the intensity of the first three factors. Tricky part, oh yes, one other thing. This energy, pitti, is what leads to what are called the jhanas. You'll see these referenced in many of in the teachings of the Buddha and in lots of places. The jhanas are deeply concentrated states of mind. But, there's always a but, right? The thing about pitti and this experience that you're having of pitti is it's so pleasant. Is this like, I never knew I could feel this good. That's what it's like. It's like, the best. This is the best, right? So of course, what do? You then grasp onto it and go, finally figured out this practice, and this is where it leads to this place where I'm really happy all the time. So I'm gonna make this happen again. Poof, gone. Just like that. You grasp it, and you just stop being mindful, you're back into just wanting. That's part of the problem. But also it's like in its more intense flavors of pitti, it's sort of like getting high. I can't say it any other way. if you're not careful, you turn this whole practice into just this really cool spiritual way to get high. Now you're stuck. Just stuck. The other thing about pitti, is it has some very distinct physical manifestations that arise. And for everyone, these manifestations are different, and even from one time to the next, are different within an individual. Things like you feel like you're floating. You're not really on. You're not grounded physically anymore. There's a sense of floatiness is the best way I can describe it. I've had times doing this where, I'm sitting with my feet on the floor, and I realize that my feet aren't on the floor anymore. At least, I mean, they're obviously there. I mean, mentally, I know, yeah, my feet are still on the floor, right? But they don't feel like that at all. I feel like there's this energetic space, and my feet are actually floating on this energetic space between me and the floor. I can't describe it any other way. That's pitti. That's a form of pitti energy, the physicalness. Sometimes you feel that you're extremely heavy. Like you're just like, poof. Like you're all of a sudden your weight just doubled and you're just solid, but not you haven't got any bigger. It's just like you're this very deeply, solidly grounded. Nothing's gonna move you. You can also, there are periods of this, I'm talking about the pleasant parts, right? There are also parts of this that can be quite unpleasant. And even, I know sometimes, for some people, it's quite scary. You start to shake, you start to vibrate. Literally, your body starts to vibrate and shake. And I can remember shaking so much I felt like I was going to fall right off my chair. That's just pitti energy arising. And it's like, oh. And so all of those things, they seem odd because like all of a sudden the nature of your body changes. But it's just this energy manifesting in these ways. Perfectly all right. mostly really pleasant. All was fascinating. All was really interesting when these things arise. That's why they call these three. Remember, I talked at the very beginning. I said these three: the investigation, energy, effort, and pithi are called the arousing factors. They're all really powering up the system to the point where you can't contain the energy and your body shakes sometimes. And that's just the nature of what happens. That leads to other things. Talk about that next week. I guess what I'm trying to say is it's okay, but if this happens to you, if this is what's happening in your practice, talk to me about it. I'll just talk about ways to work with these things skillfully, because there are things you can do. Typically, this sort of level of energetic arising only occurs on retreat, particularly longer retreats, where you've gone. Got steady enough and still enough, your mindfulness is crisp and clear, and all these the factors of awakening are manifesting, then this might happen. So probably in your day-to-day practice, you might have little twinges of these sorts of physical sensations, but it's not something that is very powerful most of the time, because our day-to-day life doesn't allow us to be as concentrated as we are in retreat. That's just the nature of retreat. And I just want to emphasize one other thing. I actually wrote a big note here. I got, see, it's a big ink scroll on the bottom of my thing here. It says, it's really important that you understand that all of this, all of these things are so fascinating, so interesting, and with the pithi energy, so pleasant. That way, it's really easy to go, got it, and this is where you get stuck. It's just we're trying to repeat this over and over and over again. And we're only at factor number four, and there's three more to go. Yeah, this is a stage along the way, and we have to be very aware, as pleasant, as wonderful as all of this is, because it is, when you're deep into these first four factors, it's really pleasant. I mean, incredibly pleasant. The kilesas are fading, disappearing, doubt is gone, sloth and torpor is gone, you're just full of, energy. So it's always really pleasant. One other thing, pity is purely a mental formation that has these physical manifestations. And I said that sometimes you see pity translated as joy or happiness. And there's another word in Pali called sukha, being the opposite of dukkha, right? Sukha is also often translated as joy or happiness, but it's worldly, and they call it worldly joy or happiness. It's happiness that comes from having wonderful stuff, physical stuff in the world, or having wonderful experiences, or being happy in that way, which is, and there's nothing wrong with any of that, of course. But pity is something that arises purely as a mental arising that then may have physical manifestations. And it may not, by the way. All these physical manifestations I was talking about are just things that happen to some people sometimes. So it's like you could be functioning at the level of pity, just like into that sort of, wow, this is so fascinating sort of space, and have none of the physical manifestations at all. And that would be fine. I guess I'm saying don't get caught into like, well, I'm not having any of these physical amazing things happening, so maybe I'm not there. Well, who knows? You'll know when you get that sense of wow, on some very deep level of wow. And that's pity in your life, in the practice. Of course, I have a bit of poetry here. This is from Dana Falls, a book, Going and In. It's called Life Here at the Edge. And I think it's quite a good description of what I'd be talking about in a sense, from her poetic point of view. When love lights a fire in the heart, don't be so quick to quell the flames. To be fully alive is to welcome the beloved in countless names and guises, not turn away the wild with the tame. Drink your fill of longing. Let love wash through in waves that lift you up and carry both your daring and your fear straight to unknown places. Yes, there is danger in not staying safely cloaked in morality and labels. But there's life here at the edge, and a choice to be made between thoughtful abandon and passionate restraint. The plaintive cry of the heart can be ignored only at the price of a fully realized life. Throw arms wide to possibilities that move and call you to come forth in freedom and in fullness. Trust the seed of grace within to blossom without sin or sorrow, for you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. That's excellent advice. Just blossom the place. Springtime, anyway, gotta blossom.